Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, I've been talking to Leila Swef, the Egyptian mother of the activist Alaa Abd El Fattah, who's been in jail for more than 10 years now. She's been telling me why she's prepared to lay her own life on the line to protest the continued detention of her son.
I assume that the vision of a mother collapsing and maybe dying should at least embarrass both governments and get them to do something.
Are you prepared to go that far?
I have enough experience of the Egyptian regimes to know that if you back down, they, you know, flatten you completely. So I can't back down.
And we explore the African origins of democracy through a system called the Khotla in Botswana. It's Thursday, the 28th of November. First, we go to Geneva. A recent report by the Internally Displaced Monitoring Center says there are now 35 million people who are internally displaced on the continent. There weren't as many back in 2009, when African governments undertook to do something about people who'd lost their homes through disaster or conflict. In a landmark deal, governments signed a legally binding agreement to tackle the causes of displacement. But wars and climate disasters have caused a relentless increase from more than 11.5 million people in 2009 to the current 35 million. The numbers have increased threefold in 15 years. Alexandra Bilak is the director of the Internally Displaced Monitoring Center. A question that might sound a little bit simple, but could you tell us what a displaced person is? How are they defined?
A person who's displaced is a person who has had no other choice but to leave their home as a result of a shock, usually caused by conflict, violence, or a sudden or slow onset disaster.
Is that a displaced person in general? So what is an internally displaced person? And how does it differ from a just somebody who's displaced?
Well, an internally displaced person is someone who is displaced, but within the borders of their country. So it is someone who does not cross an international border to seek protection elsewhere, but remains within the borders of their country.
So your report seems to suggest that people are increasingly being displaced. 2009, there was just over 11 million people who were displaced. Now we have nearly 33 million people. That's a shocking increase. What's happening? Why?
Well, first, it's important to know that nearly half of the world's internally displaced people live in Africa. And in fact, at the end of 2023, we were counting 35 million IDPs, which is indeed three times more than there were 15 years ago. The second point is that this internal displacement is highly concentrated. So 80% of those IDPs live in only five countries, and those are Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, Nigeria, and Ethiopia. And most of this displacement is being caused by conflict and violence. But we also know that disasters that are being fueled by climate change are also triggering more and more displacement. And in fact, we have now recorded six times more disaster displacements now than 15 years ago, with the majority being triggered by floods and droughts.
And we can see exactly where those people are and what's going on in those countries. There's been war, there's been climate disturbances long term. What about other parts of the continent? Perhaps we don't have as much attention to what's happening to them because they're not so much in the news.
Of course, there are a number of other countries that are experiencing internal displacement, be it caused by conflict or by environmental factors or a combination of both. So if you think, for example, about the Sahel, the Central African Republic, and many, many other countries besides the ones, the five that I mentioned. And if you take into account disaster-related displacement, then you can see that it really affects almost every country on the continent because no country, including in the world, is really spared from disasters.
Just out of interest, tell us about other parts of the world where people are similarly affected, the other half, as it were.
When we look at conflict-related internal displacement, it's true that the hotspots around the world tend to be in Africa, but also in the Middle East, for understandable reasons. Although in recent years, we've also, as you can imagine, reported some very significant increases in countries like Ukraine. And of course, right now, we're looking in particular at Palestine, Lebanon, etc. But if as soon as we start looking at disaster-related internal displacement around the world, the picture becomes much more global. And when it comes to disaster displacement, some of the regions that are most affected are in Asia, the Philippines, Indonesia, India, but also high-income countries. We do see disaster displacement happening in countries like the United States, in Japan, but also across Europe. So even though the impacts are very different from one country to the next and from one region to the next, it is very much a global phenomenon. Even though the scale of disaster displacement tends to be very high, including in high-income countries, and that is not necessarily a bad thing, because in those contexts, displacement can be a life-saving measure. It is better to become displaced by a disaster than to be killed by it. But where we start seeing the differences is in the duration of this displacement. So displacement tends to become much more difficult to resolve and protracted in countries where the coping capacities are much lower and where there has been less preparedness, or even where people have personally no access to insurance and no ability to rebuild their homes within a short period of time. And this is where you start seeing big differences between high-income, middle-income, and low-income countries. Recently, for example, in Mozambique, we see that people in that country are still displaced today following cyclones that may have hit them several years ago. So this again illustrates the fact that even though the phenomenon is global, the impacts are very, very different depending on socioeconomic factors.
We've spoken about the alarming increase in the number of people who are displaced and the size of the crises that are displacing them. But I'm also wondering whether the countries that are willing to help people are rising to the challenge, or is one of the reasons why it's taking so long for displaced people to be rehoused or sent back to where they come from to make their homes safe again. Back in 2009, lots of countries like Uganda were very willing to accept people coming into refugee camps and so on. Kenya had refugee camps. I'm just wondering whether that sense of welcome is still there.
With the issue of internal displacement, of course, it's slightly different because we're talking about a country's or a government's responsibility towards its own citizens. So it's somewhat different from a country welcoming refugees from another country. But even with internal displacement, what we have seen is a shift, a very positive shift in the last 15 years, away from one that was quite sensitive about the issue of internal displacement. Many governments, not just in Africa, but around the world, that were reluctant to acknowledge that they had internally displaced people living on their territory, and certainly reluctant to acknowledge the numbers and the scope and the scale of this displacement. Now that has changed, and we see more and more governments taking ownership and responsibility for this and acknowledging that internal displacement is happening, and indeed putting in place national policies and strategies to address it. So you mentioned 2009, this is when the African continent adopted the Kampala Convention on Internal Displacement, which is a landmark normative framework. It's unique and unprecedented. It doesn't exist anywhere else. It is specific to the African continent. And it really exemplifies the recognition by African states that internal displacement in all its complexity, whether it's caused by conflict or by disasters, needs to be addressed at the national level and needs to be part and parcel of a country's priorities. And we now can see that 34 countries have ratified this convention and are now busy integrating the provisions of the Kampala Convention into their national legislation. So, of course, there's a lot more that needs to be done, but there is some positive change politically to address this issue, and that change has been visible over the past 15 years.
Okay, then. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much to you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Alexandra Bilak, Director of the Internally Displaced Monitoring Center. Leila Suaif has not been eating for the last 2 months because she's on hunger strike. Her son, Alaa Abdel Fattah, is in jail in Egypt and she wants him released. Alaa is arguably the most high-profile political prisoner who gained prominence during the Arab Spring protests that toppled Hosni Mubarak back in 2011. Alaa has served 2 5-year sentences, first for participating in a 15-minute silent protest, and the second for reposting a Facebook post about a prisoner who had died in jail. He was supposed to be released on the 29th of September. And when that didn't happen, his mother decided to go on a hunger strike. She has lost 16 kilograms since then, and she says her body is slowly starting to shut down. She says she is prepared to go to the end with this hunger strike. I spoke to her this morning, and she told me why she won't end her hunger strike till her son is free.
Well, my son should have been released on the 29th of September. He had been 5 years in jail. His sentence, unfair as it was for 5 years. So he really should have been released at that time. When he wasn't, I decided to go on hunger strike. I started on the 30th of September. I'm not taking calories at all. I'm just taking water, sugarless herbs, and rehydration salts. This is my 60th day, and I'm hoping that my son will be released this time before I collapse completely.
Do you hold out any hope that he will be released? Because it is an extreme act to go on a hunger strike.
I don't know. I'm hoping that he will be released. My strike should put pressure both on the Egyptian government and the British government. My son is binational. He's the responsibility of both governments. And I assume that the vision of mother collapsing and maybe dying should at least embarrass both governments and get them to do something.
Are you prepared to go that far?
I am prepared to go that far. I have no other option, because now that I've started this, I have enough experience of the Egyptian regimes to know that if you back down, they, flatten you completely. So I can't back down.
What about the British government? David Lammy was very supportive when the Labour Party was in opposition, and he has called for the release of Alaa, your son. What's the stance of the government now that the Labour Party is in power and that David Lammy is essentially the Minister of Foreign Affairs?
Well, they're still supportive. The British government and David Lammy are both supportive, but so far he has not implemented, as far as I know, any of what he called for when he was Shadow Foreign Secretary. He assures me that it's very high priority for him to get both a consular visit and Alaa's release. He assures me that he's doing everything he can. I'm way past being satisfied with assurances from ministers. I need to see concrete results. I have yet to see them. I hope I will see them soon. Otherwise, well, I don't know. I mean, if what it takes to get actual concrete results is my collapse, then I suppose that's what will happen. But I sincerely hope we don't get there.
What do you know of Alaa right now? When was the last time anybody saw him, was able to give you information about how he is?
I saw Alaa on the 18th of November. I do see him on visits, but our visits are, 20 minutes once every month, or if there's an exceptional visit for some occasion in Egypt, a bit more. It's always 20 minutes. It's always behind glass. It's always talking through a mic where you know that everything you say is monitored. So the best I can say is that Alaa looked all right, but he was very down. He was certainly very worried about me, and he was feeling quite hopeless.
That couldn't have been easy for you. Did he want you to stop your hunger strike?
Alaa knows better knows me better than to ask me to back down on something that I've started. So no, he didn't ask me to do that. He just has to accept what I'm doing, like everyone else.
What would you like to see happen? He's in jail now. He's meant to have been released after serving a 5-year sentence. And I'm reading that he's going to be in jail for a further 2 years, because the 2 years before his sentence is not being regarded as part of his sentence. Do you want his immediate release?
By Egyptian law, the flawed Egyptian law, he should be released, because the normal practice is to take in pretrial detention as part of your sentence. So, yes, he should be immediately released. And what I'd like to see is Ala released and reunited with his son, who is going to be 13 next month, and he's been without his father for the past 10 years, and who is an autistic child who has an extra need for his father. So what I'd like to see is Ala released and reunited with his son.
Why have they not released him in contradiction of a law that exists in Egypt? It seems almost perverse. Do you know why? I know that you're not in the mind of the Egyptian authorities, but I'm wondering whether you have an idea of what could be happening and why they're doing this.
The Egyptian authorities don't want to release anyone, absolutely anyone. I have a friend, who another university professor who's a very good friend and who has been found innocent by the Egyptian Court of Cassation since 2018, and he's still in jail. They don't want to release anyone if they can avoid it.
So it's not directed at Ala?
I mean, it's directed at anyone who's a bit high profile, and it is directed at Ala as one of the most high profile voices of the Egyptian revolution in 2011. But also, it's not solely directed at Ala, it's directed at many others.
Amnesty International says that over 100 anti-government protesters are currently detained by the Egyptian government. Is there any way in which any process, for instance, the British government and other allies of the Egyptian government, can put pressure on them to kind of lift a heavy hand on legitimate dissent?
I'm sure if Western governments really wanted to, they could. Certainly the Egyptian regime is an ally, and it is heavily dependent on Western support and Western aid. But then again, Western governments, like all governments, really don't. This is my own personal cynical belief. They don't care about people. They don't care about freedom. They pay lip service to values like the rule of law and freedom when they need to. The way the things could happen for the better is that Western people hold their governments to account, hold them to these values that they pay lip service to, and force them to rethink their alignments.
Are you on your way to Parliament to address them?
No, I've already addressed a subcommittee in Parliament the day before yesterday. Today I'm on my way to Parliament to meet with certain members.
Are you hopeful that something will come out of it? Because there does seem to be a lot hanging on this. For instance, David Lammy's words saying there could be serious diplomatic consequences for the Egyptian government if Ala was not released. Well, in 2022, he spoke about the tremendous leverage of the $4 billion trading partnership with Egypt. It's strong language. Are you thinking that perhaps when you address certain members of parliament today, they will be prepared to put that on the table?
I hope so, and I hope Mr. Lammy himself is prepared to put that on the table. I think if he believes me, if he believes that I'm actually on hunger strike and willing to go to the end of it. Yesterday when I met him, he expressed concern for me and my health, and he also, I think, understood that this isn't going to go away. This is going to be something that will really be an embarrassment for both governments. I told him clearly that actually my body had given us a lucky break by being so resilient. I didn't expect to be on my 60th day of hunger strike and not yet collapsed. So we have a lucky break here. All of us have a lucky break here. And let's just use it and get this over with rather than go to a situation where I collapse, everyone is embarrassed, and it's irreversible.
Are you scared that it will come to that?
I'm not personally scared, but I can see how this is affecting my two daughters, and I can imagine how it's affecting Ala. So I really don't want to come to that. But I think it might. The practical part of my mind says that it probably will come to that. the optimistic part of my mind saying, no, 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 it won't. Somebody will do something before we get there.
If you could speak to the Egyptian authorities, to the president, Sisi, what would you tell them?
I would tell them first, because I know that the Egyptian authorities never believe that we're set on a course and that we're not going to back down. The first thing I would say was, please try and believe that I will not back down and act accordingly. You have a lot of interest in bilateral relations with Britain, in trade deals with Britain. If something happens to me, this will all be shadowed. You might still get your deals. I have no idea about this, but you will certainly not get any PR out of it. It will all look very shabby and very bad for everyone. So just reconsider this position and finish this and let Alaa be reunited with his family and with his son.
Thank you very much. And my heart is in my stomach as I hear you talk. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
you. All right,
you.
Then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Leyla Soueif on hunger strike to demand the release of her son, Alaa. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. The notion of democracy and the practice of it has largely been seen as a Western concept, and there is a perception that it was implemented only after independence from colonial rule. But right from the get-go, African societies had their own forms of practicing participation and consent. Democracy, in other words, and it doesn't rely on voting in a set of leaders once every 4 years or so, which is the main expression of what we call democracy today. I've been talking to someone who was intrigued by the different ways in which African societies have exercised the principles of democracy. He found examples rooted in an ancient past that are still being practiced today. Bernd Reiter is professor of political science at Texas Tech, and he told me how he began a search that led him to Botswana and the system of dikgotla, which means forum or platform.
I'm a political scientist by training, and I started in political science because I was interested in democracy from the very beginning. I got curious about democracy, the different dimensions of it, what makes it work, what can it be, what should it be, what stands in the way of democratic rule. I did a lot of work on race and gender inequalities, particularly with a focus in Latin America. And at some point, I came across the Greek democratic experience from ancient Athens, ancient Greece, and I got very curious about that. I started to read what we have as the founders of democracy, Solon, Cleisthenes, Ephialtes, Pericles, in the 6th and the 5th century, and even the 4th century BC there in Athens. But I soon realized that there's more to this story. I soon realized, and there's some scholarship around this that I became familiar with. So this story about this immaculate conception of democracy in Athens seemed to be not entirely true. As I discovered this, I got curious about other democratic experiences.
What led you to African expressions of democracy?
I consider myself a decolonial scholar. So that means I'm looking for innovation and interesting things, interesting political institutions created in the global South. This is motivated by my conviction that the problems that we face currently, the global problems we face, cannot be addressed with solutions from the global north alone. I'm very interested in finding and supplementing these our knowledge in political science or the social sciences with knowledge and experiences from the global south. So I had been doing a little bit of research in Africa before, and at some point I came across the experience of Botswana and Botswana's democratic traditions, and I became very intrigued about that. And in 2023, I was able to go there and conduct some preliminary research on their participatory democratic system, their dikgotla system.
And what is it about that system that makes you think that perhaps it is an expression of democracy that predates other forms of democracy, specifically the forms of democracy that we understand by demos, the rule of the people as handed down by Athens?
Right. So if I depart from this Greek model of, as you just say, demos, the rule of the people, if we depart from that idea that that's what democracy is, it's not about voting. The bottom line, it is about the people having a say in the crafting of the system they live under, in the laws they live under. If that's our premise, then all of a sudden a whole history opens up, actually a whole prehistory opens up of egalitarianism, of egalitarian hunter-gatherers who apparently many of them, if not most of them, ever since the history of the human species, organized in ways that did not allow for concentration of power or concentration of wealth. So when I learned about that, about this tradition of the hunter-gatherers, that's when Africa came into focus. Because if you look at the history of the human species, we understand, well, this is where the human species starts. This is also where we have the first egalitarian hunter-gatherers. And then also we have the first settlements, non-permanent and then permanent settlements. And as a political scientist, I know that once you create a political institution such as egalitarianism, these institutions tend to prevail. They tend to perdure so that once people settle, they will not just say, well, yesterday we were all egalitarian and today we're just going to accept the rule of one person or of a group thereof without resistance. So there was sort of a logical reconstruction of the transition from egalitarian hunter-gatherers and their first settlements.
So why did the understanding of democracy as a new concept in Africa, a post-colonial concept in Africa, gain ground rather than this form of democracy that you've explored? Because they did exist throughout the colonial period, even though colonizers tried to destroy them and yes. replace them with, well, more repressive systems. But ultimately, at the yeah. end of the repression, there was a sort of general glorification of the idea of democracy as understood and practiced by Western countries.
Well, you know, this is actually, there's some sort of global hegemony about this. Even in the academia, there is no attention paid, and people are not taken serious who talk about other varieties of democracy. The only game in town, just as Fukuyama argued, that it's the end of history. And to some extent, it is the end of history in a lot of minds, because colonial powers have been very, very successful in promoting one model of democracy, which is representative, which means that we elect some people and they're going to do politics for us, because that's a system also that allows to deal with elites, not with people. And of course, as we know, in the post-colonial phases, a lot of these elites were strongly connected to the former colonizing countries or to international interests, financial, economic interests. So I think there has been this tremendous promotion of representative democracy as the only game in town, as the only variety of democracy that exists. And that's, you know, this idea that there is no alternative. And a lot of my work has been to say, well, actually, there are alternatives. This idea that democracy has to look like this, that democracy has to be reduced to elections, is wrong. As a matter of fact, I would argue that elections and voting for representatives has nothing to do with democracy. So once we, and I myself, rid myself of this idea that voting for representatives and representative democracy is the only game in town, then a whole gamut of possibilities opens up and empirical experiences open up.
So you found it in Botswana, Dikotla, mm-hmm. the idea mm-hmm. of people gathered under a tree, gathered together, discussing issues, everybody having mm-hmm. their say. Where else do you think it exists?
You know, I haven't had a chance to do a lot of research, but I know from the literature that in Lesotho we have a similar system. What I found so special about Botswana was that this tradition survived very strongly, and this tradition was also integrated into the constitution, the post-independence constitution, and it has maintained a vigor. Now, most people who study this, they focus on chiefs or traditional kings. I would argue that's not the point. The point is there still are today people getting together on a regular basis, debating politics, becoming knowledgeable about politics, holding their government accountable. And that's really the important part. Now, I'm aware this exists elsewhere. I wish I had the time and the money to go study it elsewhere as well. I hope I can do this in the future. But I find it in Botswana, because of the way colonialism worked there, the indirect rule and the sort of neglect of the Brits allowed it to maybe maintain more of its original character.
Right. But what I'm mm-hmm. wondering is, do they actually have power to change mm-hmm. circumstances, to change things, and to displace leaders that they don't like, if we're talking yeah. about, you know, a form of democracy that actually works?
Right. I do not think that at this point the Kutla has all that power. I know that it used to have this power before colonialism. I know that it got integrated into the government. I know that at this point the parliament has a lot of power. I also know that the chiefs are together in a forum that has only the power to consult, to offer advice. But still, I see two things. I see on the one side there is the possibility for this to expand. It seems that in the past it was more powerful. It seems it was less distorted than in South Africa through colonialism. And it also seems that there's another aspect to this, is that because people are able to participate in a meaningful way and to actually have a voice, and for that voice to actually have an impact, there is also a learning, an impact on the citizens, on the participants, which fights off alienation and, you know, fake news, because they are able to see and witness and participate and understand how government works, which just seems to be the precondition, one of the basic preconditions for democracy, sort of the practical knowledge required. So,
and we shouldn't forget that democracy as practiced in Athens, in ancient civilizations, or those particular civilizations, did not involve all the people either. They
correct.
Were also involved elites, and not women. Women were excluded as well, and people without property.
Exactly.
And so
not, I mean, it was a highly exclusionary system, and that's also, of course, part of this, you know, of this very dominant approach. In Athens, I think only about 20% of the people were actually allowed to participate. Only people who had served in the military, no immigrants, no women. And of course, the whole society heavily relied on the labor of the enslaved. And yet people are very quick to overlook that and focus on the positive of Athens. Whereas in the African experience, these things that are, there is no perfect system. I'm not saying that the Kotla system is perfect, but I am saying there is something very interesting here that has great potential. And if Botswana or any other country seek to further the democracy, democratize further, it's not by delving deeper into British traditions, but it's into valorizing their own traditions and focusing on the Kotla system.
Bernd Reiter, professor of political science at Texas Tech. Focus on Africa was produced by Bella Hassan, Rob Wilson, Victor Silva, and Amy Leibovitz here in London. Carney Sharp was a senior journalist. Francesca Dunn, our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.